Okay. Yeah, this is one of the shorter works in philosophy. But let's just take a, I want to look at, real closely at the definitive articles, but before we do that, let's see here. Okay. Hold on a second. We don't want that. Where is the supplement that I'm thinking of? Second supplement. No, not secret article. No, this isn't. All right, let me just take a guarantee for perpetual peace. Well, all right, we'll go back to this. Let's take a look at the actual articles. Sections 1 and 2, a close-up here. All right, so remember the definitive articles are the ones that actually establish the mechanism for achieving perpetual peace. The first one, remember, is that the civil constitution of every state should be republican. Well, and once again, by republican, what he means is a government that explicitly recognizes that the foundations of its legitimacy are in the consent of the governed. And remember, Kant, as an Enlightenment figure, thinks that that's critical. That's a critical moral advance over the older period in which monarchies in particular were dominant. And the reason why it's a critical moral advance is that it treats people, republics treat people as rational adults, as adults who are in full possession of their reason. And if you think about it, it makes sense because, you know, we don't, for example, allow children to sign contracts. If a contract is signed by someone who is underage, it's invalidated. And it can be easily invalidated in a judicial procedure. And the reason why is that the act of signing a contract involves a consent that is rationally informed. And we assume that children are not yet in full possession of their rational faculties. The idea that government rests on the consent of the governed, and this is central to social contract theory. In other words, we're making a contract with one another to create a common judicial and legal mechanism that involves the assumption that the people who are giving their consent are rational in character, that they are rational adults. And that's what Kant sees missing from monarchy. You know, I've talked about this plenty of times in the past, that even the good kings are rulers who, at least in their ideology, say that they rule on behalf of their subjects, you know, that they rule in the interest of their subjects. But there's a great difference between ruling in the interest of someone else and allowing that person to rule him or herself. And so for Kant, the distinction between the republic and the monarchy is that the monarchy is based on the idea of rule in the interest of the subjects or the citizens, and the republic is based on the idea of self-rule, and that involves the recognition of the rational character of the people involved. Are you going to ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You looked like you were
ready. I was just thinking to myself that, well, when you say a person can rule the public, but they can't rule themselves, but...
Well, now the idea is that republican government is a government in which the citizens do rule themselves. Whether they rule themselves through representatives or whether they rule themselves directly, right? You hear this all, I mean, this is a part of the ideology, anyway. Whether it's the reality is another question. Yeah, because you see, I mean, in the United States, we've talked about this as well, it's easy to see that there's been a degeneration in Republican standards. We have the best Congress money can buy, right? The best Congress money can buy. And it's blatant. I mean, you read the papers, and there are no bones about it. You know, different financial interests simply buy Congress people. And we know this. You know, whenever any crucial vote comes up and someone votes on behalf of, I don't know, the interests of the insurance companies or military producers or whatnot, it's easy to document that these people are getting tons of money from those interests. And so that's obviously a dilution of Kant's idea of self-rule. Right? So, but still the ideology even, in our republic is one in which self-rule is emphasized. You know, the people are said to govern. Whether they do it effectively or not is another story, right? Okay, but let's take a look at the second article, because it's the second article, as I said, that's extremely significant. The law of nations shall be founded on a free on a federation of free states. Let's read through parts of it. People as states, like individuals, may be judged to injure one another merely by their coexistence in the state of nature, i.e., while independent of external laws. Now, remember that social contract theory, and Kant accepts this, says that in the state of nature, without laws, without political institutions, we are involved in a state of war. And by war, what they mean is not that there are necessarily active hostilities, but that we all must be prepared for active hostilities. We have to regard one another as threats. And remember, there's that famous passage in Hobbes's Leviathan where Hobbes says, if you don't think that people in the state of nature are dangerous to one another, then why is it that you lock your doors even with the existence of laws and judicial institutions and so forth? Even under, even in the civil state, even in the politically organized state, we still have an eye out for the aggression of other people. And without any laws at all, of course, that eye out for the aggression of other people becomes the salient characteristic of social life. You know, for Hobbes, and Kant accepts this, people are dangerous to one another. But Kant, as I said, you know, draws a little bit, as I've said in the past, draws different conclusions from this. People are dangerous to one another, but they're capable of overcoming that danger by developing the correct kinds of social and political institutions. So here Kant is saying that remember, once the social contract is entered into domestically and governments are constituted domestically, that still leaves nation states in relation to one another in a state of nature. So we enter into a state of peace with one another by constituting a government and living under law, but our state, our nation state, is in relation to every other nation state, and is in the same relation that we were prior to signing the social contract. There's a state of war internationally. Nation states exist in relation to one another in a state of war. And remember, once again, this doesn't mean that hostilities are active. It means that hostilities are always capable of breaking out, and that each nation state must regard every other nation state as a potential threat. So the question is, how do you get beyond that? How do you get beyond the international state of war? Each of them may and should, for the sake of its own security, demand that the others enter with it into a constitution similar to the civil constitution. In other words, the solution for the state of war internationally, Kant says at this point, is similar to the solution to the state of war domestically. We need to enter in mutually into a constitution that puts an end to violent conflict, that creates an international state of peace. Hold on 1 second. For under such a constitution, each can be secure in his own right. In other words, what we're seeking is security. What we're seeking is protection from aggression, which is the same thing as security, which is the same thing as a state of peace.
Yeah. How do you uphold those international laws that are supposed to prevent people from it attacking each other?
Let's take a look. Let's read through the section, okay? And then we can sort of pick it apart and see if there are weaknesses in it, okay? This would be a league of nations. Now, here's the famous phrase that was lifted by the founders of the original League of Nations after the First World War. This would be a league of nations, but it would not have to be a state consisting of nations. Now, a state consisting of nations means that, by nations, what Kant means is communities that are able to trace themselves, or at least on the level of thought, communities that think of themselves as connected through nativity, through having been, through its citizens having been born within the territorial limits of the state as it defines itself. So for example, but a state of nations would be a set of such nations brought together by a common government, brought together under the rule of a common government.
So that's like the United Nations?
It's sort of like the, well, it's actually the model here that he has in mind is the United States. So think about it, right? Massachusetts is a state. You know, it's a nation in concepts. What defines, it's not, birth isn't so significant when it comes to citizenship of states, but you can think of Massachusetts as though it were an independent nation. And in fact, under the original Articles of Confederation, it more or less was. The original Articles of Confederation that bound the colonies together during the Revolutionary period were very loose. It was only with the Constitution that a strong federal government was created. But what he's saying is that even the model of the United States, a model in which states have considerable autonomy and independence, but there's still a federal government that rules overall, even that is not suitable for the globe. Kant is saying that even that kind of a federal government with a strong central authority is not going to work globally. It's not going to work internationally. Now, he gives an argument here which is rather weak, I think, if you take a look at it. What he says here is that the reason why is that this would be contradictory. Since a state implies the relationship of superior legislating to an inferior obeying, i.e. the people and many nations in one state would then constitute only one nation. This contradicts the presupposition, for here we have to weigh the rights of nations as against each other so far as they are distinct states and not amalgamated into one. This is a complicated sentence. There's no doubt about it. Yeah?
And he's talking about like bringing the world into one, right? Saying that China, Germany, the United States are all one, and he's saying that's impossible. It will never be like that.
But he's giving a reason. And the reason that he gives here is that to do so would involve a contradiction. And the contradiction is that by talking about independent states, we assume that each independent state has full authority over its own people. But when we talk about the creation of a state of nations, in which all of these states come together under a single authority, the single authority would negate the power of the members, the member nations, and that would be a contradiction. The only thing I'm objecting to here is the word contradiction. The reason why, I think, is evident. There's no contradiction. There might be tensions in the fact that we have both a state government and a federal government. But there's no overt contradiction. I'm thinking about the United States as a kind of model, small-scale model, of what Kant is saying is impossible on the global scale. In other words, it seems to me that it could be perfectly possible to create a situation in which a great deal of authority is still located in the local groupings, what he's calling the states, and yet there would be a global authority. Yes.
So his argument is more for like an EU type system, than a United States sort of system.
That's an interesting point. What do you can you?
Well, the EU, each country retains its sovereignty, but still adheres to the rules that are made by the EU councils.
Yeah. That's a very good point. And there's a lot of skepticism, obviously, about that system developing in a more strongly centralized direction. You know, the Dutch, for example, voted against the European Constitution, and so did the French. And then, you know, through kind of back channels, the legislatures of those two countries passed another version of the Constitution, and so the EU has now been created. But the idea behind the EU, even though there's a European-wide parliament and so forth, is exactly as you're saying, that each nation retains full sovereignty over its own affairs, with the exception of very well-defined issues, like common currency, like if they finally get a military policy that in place that actually creates common military and so forth. And they only are bound, each nation is only as bound as long as it decides to remain in the EU. So at any time, at least formally speaking, at any time, France could get out of it, Greece could get out of it, and so forth. Yeah?
Well, the interesting thing that I've been reading that there's been some economic trouble in some of the states.
In Greece in particular.
In Greece in particular, and they're talking, I know France and Germany are talking, they're arguing over a possible bailout of their currency, and it seems like it's testing the limit of sovereignty, because if they do that, then they'll be putting more money into one state over another state. And
yet if they don't, then the failure of the Greek economy is in danger of sinking the EU economically.
Right. Yeah.
But the EU is interesting. The European Union is interesting, because what you're seeing here, and we're seeing in other places as well, is moves beyond the old nation-state form. In other words, there are new forms of political organization globally emerging that are no longer strictly nation-state oriented. Yeah.
If I may say so, there wasn't actually a precedent for the United States for secession until the Confederate States of America fired on Fort Sumter. I mean, people assumed and presumed that, they could secede legally, and you could say that for any of these institutions, really, is, how can you, could you just secede from say, the UN Security Council? That would cause a pretty big rift.
Vermont had a clause in its state constitution that 200 years after joining the United States, the citizens of Vermont would consider whether or not they wanted to remain. And I remember when the bicentennial of Vermont's, which is was essentially the bicentennial of the U.S., when the bicentennial of Vermont's membership in the United Nations came up, there was a movement to secede. There was a secessionist movement in Vermont. It never got very far. It's hard to imagine Vermont seceding, especially imagine that the rest of the U.S. boycotted Vermont economically. They'd have to live off of milk and ice cream, right? They have a very limited economic base. But I think it was the whole notion that it is within the right of individual states to secede is still a live issue in Vermont, even in the 20th century, late 20th century.
Well, yes, but the issue of what actually happens when you secede was settled pretty clearly. And Mr. Lincoln played it very well. He didn't do anything about the secession until they fired on Fort Sumter. Mm-hmm. It was a very peaceful, they just pussyfooted around the whole thing until then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're into history here, at least. They're lies, damn lies, and this history. Okay. All right. Well, let's go down here. When we see the attachment of savages to their lawless freedom, now Kant here uses the word savages tongue in cheek, because there are other passages in Perpetual Peace in which he calls Europeans savages and reverses the traditional relationship between Europe and the rest of the world. So the savagery of the European colonizers is far more extreme than what is supposed to be the savagery of the native populations of the world. But nonetheless, he's using the word savage here to mean people who live without formal legal and political systems. We see that the attachment of savages to their lawless freedom, preferring ceaseless combat to subjection to a lawful constraint which they might establish, and thus preferring senseless freedom to rational freedom, when we see this, we regard it with deep contempt as barbarity, rudeness, and a brutish degradation of humanity. Notice here the distinction between senseless freedom and rational freedom. And I take it that what Kant means by senseless freedom is the idea that everyone has the right to do whatever they want. Period. And for Kant, such freedom is senseless because it's ultimately self-canceling. Remember, that is the state of nature, according to Kant. when everyone has the freedom to do whatever they want, then no one can be safe from the actions of other people. There's a distinction that he draws between senseless freedom and rational freedom. Now, rational freedom is the freedom of citizens in a well-ordered political society in which laws protect us from the aggression of others. You know, it's only in such a law-governed society that the freedom of individuals becomes genuine, in a sense. It can be exercised without worry about interference on the part of others. So we regard lawless freedom with contempt. Accordingly, one would think that civilized people, each united in a state, would hasten all the more to escape, the sooner the better, from such a depraved condition. But instead, each state places its majesty, for it is absurd to speak of the majesty of the people here, in being subjects to no external juridical constraint. And the splendor of its sovereign consists in the fact that many thousands stand at his command to sacrifice themselves for something that does not concern them, and without his needing to place himself in the least danger. You know, Kant is referring here to the monarchies that were the dominant political form of Europe. And what he's saying is that rather than enter into a state of peace with respect to other nations, rather than entering into an international state of law, sovereigns prefer the majesty that comes with their ability to order their citizens into combat for whatever motives appear to be beneficial to them. Now, Kant thinks that that would end with the adoption of republican government, because in republics, the people who fight and the people who suffer are also the people who ultimately have to make the decision about whether or not to go to war. And this is one reason why he thinks that republics are crucial for preparing the ground for an international peace. The chief difference between European and American savages lies in the fact that many tribes of the latter have been eaten by their enemies. This is the bad anthropology that Kant is working off of during his period, right? The cannibalism is really very, very infrequent in the Americas. It does occur in some Amazonian tribes, and there it is ritualistic rather than, it's not a matter of people supplementing their diets with the bodies of others. You eat a bit of the body of someone else in order to get some of the power that person had.
Your computer's running low on.
Why am I not plugged? So this is obviously not working. Ah, here we go, now I'm charging. Am I? Yes, yeah. Now I'm charging. So the top outlet is dead. Okay. Thanks for letting me know that. But Kant's saying that the difference between European and American savages lies in the fact that many tribes of the latter have been eaten by the enemies, while the former know how to make better use of their conquered enemies than to dine off of them. They know better how to use them to increase the number of their subjects and the quantity of instruments for ever more extensive war. Now, this is the first reference we're getting to the beginnings of European colonialism. Now, let's say, let's skip this sentence here. Let's go down to the fourth paragraph. States do not plead their cause before a tribunal. War alone is their way of bringing suits. I think this is interesting because, you know, what it suggests is something that's implicit, and what makes explicit is something that's implicit in social contract theory, and that is that the equivalent of going to war in a state of peace, in an organized political society, is bringing somebody to court. If you have a dispute, you don't take out your machine gun unless you live in Alaska and know Sarah Palin, right? you go to court and you seek a judgment. And you seek a judgment on the basis of an impartial application of the law. And that is exactly what states without international law do not do. They rely once again upon the use of force. Yeah.
So, I was just saying, like Somalia.
Well, name a state.
So it's saying basically saying that don't take the law into your hand, meaning that you know if there's law, you don't just disregard the law and proceed with your own action.
Well, see, the issue is that without a government, without an agreed upon, forget about government even, without an agreed upon legal system internationally, there is no law to take into your own hands. There is only your own hands. See, without international law, nations are forced to protect their interests through the application of aggression. So, and without law, without an international law, there is no one to say that that's wrong, any more than there is anyone to say that it's wrong for you, in a state of nature, to protect your own interests through the use of force. The only time that the use of force becomes wrong is when there is a law that regulates people's relations with one another. And a law, so therefore a law that prohibits the direct use of force. Now, there is such a law in domestic society. You know, there are laws on the books in the United States, or laws on the books in Nigeria, or laws on the books in Brazil, which establish a state of peace between Brazilians or on the one hand, or Americans on the other, or Nigerians on the other, right? But there is no international law to establish a state of peace between nations. And since that's the case, nations are like individuals were prior to the emergence of laws and political institutions. The only way that they have to protect their interests is through aggression, and there is nothing to say that they are wrong to do so. Yeah?
Would aggression be counted only by war? Or what about the idea of sanctions or refusing to trade with somebody, for example, Cuba, refusing to trade with them even though it's vital that they get certain supplies? If you do an embargo on them and refuse anything coming in and out, would that be considered an act of aggression even though it's not war?
I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I mean, sort of, but I mean, then it kind of, I'm not sure if that's considered violence or if it's just considered aggression.
Well, you know, once again, let's get to the point where it even makes sense to start talking about embargoes. Right? Embargoes really only make sense once there is something like a large-scale world organization, or at least a network of nations. So it's not just the United States that embargoes Cuba, it's many nations that embargo Cuba under U.S. leadership. And now there's a great deal of tension, by the way, between the U.S. and Latin America in general, because most Latin American countries want the embargo lifted and the U.S. still embargoes, right? But we're not even at that point yet in Kant's argument. We're at the point in which there are no connections between nations except connections in which war becomes the issue. There's just no international legal context at all. Right? Okay. He says, but by war and its favorable issue in victory, this is an important fact, I think, that a lot of us tend to forget, but by war and its favorable issue in victory, right is not decided. And though by a treaty of peace this particular war is brought to an end, the state of war, of always finding a new pretext to hostilities, is not terminated. What does he mean by saying, by war and its favorable issue in victory, right is not decided? By war and its favorable issue in victory, right is not decided. Yeah.
Nicole. Does it mean because usually whoever wins, whatever they believe, the people from like the losing area, it's just that's what they have to,
Yeah, think about it. I mean, think about the boundaries that now exist between nations. You know, that nations sort of hold on to as though they were sacred. They're absolutely sacred. Well, most of those boundaries are the result of the outcome of past wars. But wars simple settle things simply by violence. So the status quo is really a status quo that has no right behind it. It's simply the outcome of the past use of force. You know, in the world as it currently exists, in essence, might makes right, you know, or the issue of right doesn't even enter in. You know, there's simply might that settles the issue. The United States, for example, annexed a large part of Mexico as a result of the Spanish, the Mexican-American War. And by the way, that part of Mexico is now that area of the United States that is most at issue when it comes to so-called illegal immigration. I mean, it's not ironic that the majority of Mexicans who are coming into the U.S. illegally are coming back to an area that was once owned by Mexico. No longer owned by Mexico, it's owned by the United States. But it's owned by the United States because the United States beat the hell out of Mexico in a war and took it. So what Kant is saying is that status quo is based on the outcome of force and not on what he calls right. But he goes further than this. He says, nor can this be declared wrong. And he's not saying that the U.S. is wrong to have annexed Mexico. He says, nor can this be declared wrong, considering the fact that in this, each state is the judge of its own case. If there's no international law to settle these issues, then all we have is the application of force and the results of that application.
So it's the same. If there's no law for a crime, then it's not a crime.
There's no crime. Exactly right. Yeah, if there's no law that defines what a criminal offense is, then there's no such thing as crime. If there is no international law that regulates relations between states and enables them to settle disputes peaceably, then there is no such thing as criminal annexation. Yeah?
So let's say that someone enacts a part of, for example, maybe Native Americans, there wasn't any international law at the point. So do they constantly say that this is our land, we want it back. Do they not have legitimate claim to ask for it back because there was no international law at the time?
Well,
no, they don't have any legitimate claim to ask for it back. It's not allowed for it. This whole place would have been, you know, Manhattan is, you know, what was there before? It's not there now. They're not going to give it back. It doesn't matter about the claim.
Well, but let's take a little bit of a, yeah, all right. You're talking about real politics here, but let's take a little harder look at this. The Native American land is taken, it's annexed, and so forth, but there still is such a thing as U.S. law. And part of that law, presumably, are a set of treaties that were signed, and a set of treaties that were signed and then violated. So in many cases, when Native Americans pursue their interests, what they're pursuing is an acknowledgement and respect for the treaties that were originally signed. In other words, they're appealing to U.S. law. You see, it's in relation to U.S. law that the violation of treaties and the annexation, at least of some lands, is defined as unjust.
That's only in instances where there were treaties, though.
True. It doesn't settle everything. That's true. But let's say, yes, go ahead.
Hold on. Are you guys talking about back then when that happened or now?
Somewhat both.
Yeah. What hangs on the distinction? Why is the distinction important?
Well, because when they first came over and then the whole thing with the Native Americans happened, would that be considered still like the U.S. law because it wasn't fully done yet, was it?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. You're talking about after the Constitution was...
I don't know. I'm not really good with the timeline. I just know that they came over and just did that whole thing. And so I don't know. Because one of the
there was certainly nasty stuff done in the Northeast when the Pilgrims first landed and so forth. But the real genocide occurred when the European population moved west.
Oh.
And this was 19th century. Around the time of the Civil War, a little bit before, a little bit after the Civil War. And at that point, of course, there was a whole constitutional framework in place along with treaties.
Yeah. Well, I guess maybe I was confused because I took a class and it was mostly on the northeastern tribes.
Right.
Like, so around here, and that was...
Well, it's an important issue. You're raising the issue, really, of how do you redress past wrongs? How do you address past wrongs, and where does the right lie on the part of people who have been dispossessed of land? I mean, this is a huge issue in Israel, right? Do the Palestinians have a right of return, for example? Do they have a right of return, which is, you know, it's an essential bone of contention?
They claim they do.
And what does Israel say?
I don't know.
But why not? What's the rationale that Israel gives?
Well, I guess in a way, like, they just all separately claim that they have an equal right to that land, mm-hmm. based on their books. But then it goes to that childish place where my book is right, your book is right, and then it's just a matter of opinion. I think it's like a big discussion in Israel too, still today, and it always was. And there are different sides to it, and people really argue a lot, you know, whether or not we actually came and took their land. Mm-hmm. And in a way, yes, and in a way, no, because when the British were there and they were dividing the land as they were leaving and giving independence, they did really comply with the British decision. So
yeah.
In a way, I mean, don't get me wrong, like, at this point it's just way blown out of proportion, and they're like in a bad place. They live in crap, they really do.
Yeah.
They really, really do. But there's like a lot of things that go into it.
And it also depends upon how orthodox your interpretation of Jewish history is, right?
Right.
Because the religious right wants to claim that the land was given to the children of Israel by God.
Right.
Right? And so any Palestinians that were occupying it were there illegitimately to begin with.
Right.
Right.
They were actually there first.
Yeah.
To be honest.
And American Indians were there first too. See, and Africans were taken into slavery.
Conversely, though, Jerusalem, when it was surrendered to the first jihadists, one of the terms of capitulation on behalf of the Christian population of Jerusalem, which had been a Byzantine possession, mm-hmm. was that the new Bedouin rulers drive out all the Jews.
Let me just leave you with one thought. That's a depressing thought. Let me leave you with one question. Does it make sense to talk about redressing past wrongs? Or does it make sense to talk about achieving justice for existing populations? See what I'm saying? You know, the language of reparations, and they're great, they're important reparations movements. You know, there's a movement among African Americans to achieve reparation for slavery, for example. But the truth is that if you trace back the history of your own, if you go back very far in your own story, what you will find is that almost everyone in this classroom is the result of some kind of dispossession somewhere. You know, the European peasantry was dispossessed of its land through the enclosure movement that created a wave of immigration to the United States. Jews were certainly dispossessed of a great deal during the Nazi period and before, as a result of the pogroms. Africans were dispossessed by being taken into slavery and so forth. It's hard to imagine a framework for justice that says we must right all past wrongs. Because if that's the framework, then we'll have to spend the rest of eternity figuring out exactly how each individual has been wronged. Yeah, isn't justice really a theme that has to do with meeting people's needs in the present, no matter what has happened in the past? I'm throwing this out. I'm not asserting it dogmatically, because to be honest, I don't know. Okay, folks, have a good weekend.
Is that the signing sheet?
Yeah, it's the signing sheet.
Nobody signed it.
Well, no one signed it. That's okay. That's okay. Don't worry about it. No one came today. What was the, you started to make a point. I'll cut you off.
What? Which point?
About the Bedouins and the...
Oh, it's very simple.
Before you start making your point, I just wanted to let you know I won't be here like on Friday just for that doctor's appointment.
But we'll miss you, though.
All right. Just thought I'd give you a heads up. Monday.
Okay.
You should hear this one, too.
Okay.
The conditions under which the Christian population of Jerusalem surrendered in the first jihad was that all Jews be expelled from Jerusalem in exchange for our surrender to jihad.
That didn't happen.
So, well, no, it did for a while. The guys came back.
We did. We like it there.
Yeah, it's a nice place.
That movie, it's based on the Jewish Kingdom of Heaven.
No, I haven't.
What is it called?
Kingdom of Heaven?
Of Heaven, yeah.
Oh, I'll have to take a look at it.
I'll bring you one copy of that.
All right. Don't expect to get it back.
No.
Get all these gifts from students.
I'm sure it's awesome. Good.
My problem is that students loan me things, and then 2 years later, they want them back. And I don't know what the hell happens to them.
That would be yours, yeah?
Yeah.
Take
care.
Thank you.
I'll bring it on Monday.
Okay. Take care.
See you later.
See ya. Take care, Jason.